This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The early Earth was no place for life as we know it, spewing volcanoes, meteor strikes, toxic hydrogen cyanide. Top it all off with an unhealthy dose of ultraviolet radiation. They didn't call it the Hadean Eon for nothing. But what seems so inhospitable to us today may have actually been the perfect place for the basic precursors of life to emerge. Basic biological machinery like RNA, proteins, lipids, and so on. My next guest has recreated these early hellish conditions in the name of science to see what might pop out of that primordial soup. And he got a pleasant surprise. John Sutherland is a group leader at the Medical Research Council's Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge in the UK. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
It sounds like you sort of redid the famous Miller-Urey experiment in 1952.
So it sounds like it at first sight or first glance, but in fact what we did was really pretty different. We actually took hydrogen cyanide and hydrogen sulfide, two things which were thought to be common on the early Earth, and irradiated them. Whereas Miller and Urey basically took a simulated early Earth atmosphere and zapped it with electricity. So the two things are similar in a sense, but the differences are pretty important from a chemical point of view.
So tell us why you chose what you chose to use as those ingredients.
So hydrogen cyanide is produced when meteorites which contain carbon impact the planet if there's nitrogen in the atmosphere. Of course, Earth's atmosphere had nitrogen in it. And so hydrogen cyanide would have been produced during the late heavy bombardment 3.9 billion years ago on the early Earth. Hydrogen sulfide is another thing that would have been present, spewed out from volcanoes and so on. And because the Earth had no oxygen at the time, ultraviolet light from the sun would have reached the surface. So the combination of the two gases and the ultraviolet light seemed like the right combination of things to use.
Mm-hmm. And so what popped out of your primordial soup there?
Well, a number of things popped out one after the other. And so what we did was to, first of all, characterize the first things that came out and then subject them to repeated cycles of the conditions. And then we gradually pieced together a network of reactions. And we had in mind that we might be capable of making the ribonucleotide precursors to nucleic acids. But amazingly, we found that almost inevitably associated with those were precursors of amino acids and lipids.
Wow, so you got better results than you had expected.
Much better results than we expected. And the really key thing was the fact that it seemed as though these other molecules are inevitably associated with the nucleic acid precursors. So this has some sort of implications for how biology might have got kick-started afterwards.
Mm-hmm. The chemical evolution of life, in other words.
That's right. I mean, I think previously people had assumed that the chemistry to make the various building blocks, the nucleic acids, the amino acids and the lipids, must have been really quite different. And so there was no way that chemistry to make all three of those groups of molecules could have occurred at the same time and place. And that had led people to assume that nucleic acids or proteins or lipids, one or other of them, came first in biology and then kind of invented the others. But this actually suggests that the common chemistry can make all of those bits and pieces. Hmm. So it suggests that life might have gotten going by having all of the three basic subsystems together from the very beginning.
Is there something special about the structure of hydrogen cyanide that sort of predicts the appearance of these biological building blocks?
Yes, there's something special about the structure of hydrogen cyanide, and more particularly its reactivity. And I wouldn't say it predicts the chemistry, but the chemistry is predisposed. In other words, the chemistry that takes place is writ in the structure and reactivity of hydrogen cyanide. And that, to a chemist, you know, that's the kind of thing that makes chemists smile.
Yeah. What else do you need to make us smile even more? What would you like to see happen?
What we'd really like to do is to go beyond this. We'd like to sort of tidy it up a bit and find the loose ends. But we'd like to then say, okay, the stage is set with the proteins or the amino acids, the nucleic acid precursors, and the lipids. We'd now like to try and sort of take that to the stage where we've got polymeric materials and they're interacting with each other and things are starting to happen which are are more lifelike than the basically lifeless set of building blocks we've got at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Sounds exciting, John Sutherland. We'll check back in with you and check on your progress. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
That's my pleasure.
John Sutherland, group leader at the Medical Research Council's Laboratory of Molecular Biology in Cambridge, investigating the earliest flickers of chemical life on Earth. Now, a new sort of selected short subjects in science right here in our studio. Last August, researchers reported that Ebola virus circulating in West Africa was picking up mutations twice as fast as researchers had seen before, raising concerns that the current strain could be evolving in ways around potential antiretroviral drugs and vaccines, or becoming more virulent or lethal. But a new genetic analysis of Ebola samples from Mali suggests there's nothing all that unusual or alarming about the evolution of this particular strain. We talked to Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at NIH in Maryland.
What this paper shows is that if you look at the rates of mutations, they're not significantly different than what has been seen in Central African outbreaks, and so that the variation in general remains low, perhaps alleviating concerns that we were in a situation where we were going to see substantial changes in the virus.
That appeared in the journal Science this week, and joining me now with a few of her selected short subjects in science is Arielle Duane-Ross, a science reporter at The Verge. She's here in our New York studios. Welcome back to Science Friday.
Hi, Ara.
Let's talk about your first story you've picked up today is a new study about child abuse in the journal Science. Tell us about that.
Right. The study was published yesterday, and it sort of contradicts some of the prevailing ideas about the intergenerational transmission of child abuse. That idea says that kids who have been abused and then go on to be parents are more likely to abuse their own kids. Mm-hmm. Now, what this study did is that they were able to show that parents who were physically abused as kids aren't more likely to be violent with their own kids. But there is still some sort of intergenerational transmission in the sense that the kids of parents who experienced neglect and sexual abuse, not physical abuse, were more likely to experience that in their own lives. Mm-hmm. The study is unusual. It's unusual in the sense that it's very large. It was long term. Most of the time, the way that people study this is that they will find reports of child abuse, and then they will talk to the parents and try to find out about their own histories.
Yeah.
But what this study did is that they actually were able to have a long-term control. So they picked up 900 kids who had been abused in the late 60s, early 70s, and also 600 kids who hadn't, or who didn't have documented cases anyways.
Mm-hmm.
And then they followed them, and they interviewed them at the age of 29, and they interviewed them at the age of 47, and they also talked to their own kids, and they had a little bit of help with Child Protective Services reports, and they were able to find that parents who are physically abused aren't more likely to do that to their own kids.
Yeah, that sort of breaks that mythology. Mythology there.
Yeah.
Your next selection is an unusual study because it's a study looking specifically at women with autism, not the more widely diagnosed and widely studied men with autism.
Right. So men are 4 times more likely to be diagnosed with autism. Now, there are some ideas that maybe women are underdiagnosed, but women in general tend to have more severe forms of autism. Now, what's interesting about this study is that they found a gene that is associated with severe forms of autism. What's really cool is that because they looked at women who tend to have a more severe form, they were able to identify mutations that makes you more likely to develop the severe form of autism. And that's really unusual in the sense that by looking at a group that was so small and that's understudied, they were able to find mutations that will be helpful for people who have very severe forms of autism, regardless of whether they're men or women. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty great. That shows that studying women really pays off.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the last up, something really quirky. Tell us about the punk rocker frog.
Right. So some researchers found this punk rocker frog, and this frog is in Ecuador. The frog is about 23 millimeters long, And it can apparently change the shape of its skin. So when the researchers found the frog, it had really, really spiky skin, and they collected it. And, you know, they thought it looked like a punk rocker frog. And the next morning, they looked at the specimen that they had collected, and it had completely smooth skin. And they figured, did we, you know, take the wrong frog? Did we make a mistake?
Picked up the wrong one on the
right,
out in
exactly.
The field there. Yeah.
But then the researchers, you know, decided to put it back in the cup with moss and noticed that it had become spiky again. This has never been recorded before. The frog was discovered in 2009. And, you know, this was completely unusual.
So when it was in the moss, because the moss was sort of spiky, you know, it's not smooth, mm-hmm. it developed the spiky part of its skin.
Right, and it's completely spiky. It really does look kind of dangerous, but it can apparently become very smooth.
And when they took it out and they put it on a little white sheet of paper, it sort of said, "Hey, I'm not in the moss anymore.
Right,
I should match my surrounding."
Exactly. So the idea is that it's probably doing that to protect itself from birds or other predators. But we don't know how the frog manages to do this. We have no idea.
You know, what's interesting is that we've done film about an octopus. The octopus is able to do this all the time underwater, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
That whole family of
cephalopods are amazing at that.
Maybe they got it the same place somewhere, you know, in evolution.
Maybe there's some evolutionary connection that's possible.
Well, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. We'll see you
again
in the future.
Take care.
Ariel Duane-Ross is a science reporter at The Verge. We're going to take a break, and coming up, two things you never thought would get together and go together, climate change and dance. And you know what? It works. We'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Maybe you think you've heard every conversation there is to have about global warming and climate change. Maybe you even heard a lot of those conversations on this program. How high will the seas rise? How do we wean ourselves off of fossil fuels? What will replace them? Well, last Wednesday, a very different kind of climate change conversation played out at the American Museum of Natural History. But this conversation was mostly silent, except for some nice music under the museum's iconic blue whale. Some 30 dancers raced, fell, pushed, teetered on tiptoe in a real-time demonstration of how complex systems work together or fall apart. The dance called On the Nature of Things is an experiment to see if dance can shake up the climate change conversation. It's also a collaboration between two heavyweights in their fields. Carol Armitage is a choreographer. She choreographed the dance. She's the founder and artistic director of the contemporary ballet company Armitage Gone in New York City, sometimes called the punk ballerina. Armitage has been part of the dance world for over 40 years, even dancing in the company of Merce Cunningham, her mentor. Welcome to Science Friday. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
Dr. Paul Ehrlich is a well-known name. He's a professor of biology and population studies at Stanford. He's been warning us about the dangers of overpopulation and overconsumption, well, for almost half a century. And he's best known for his 1968 book, The Population Bomb. And he wrote and performed a narration for the dance and is sort of losing his voice after all those performances. Welcome back, Paul. Good to see you again.
Great to be here.
Carol, let's talk about the dance. Walk us through it. What's the story that the dancers are telling us here?
Well, I wanted to take people on a trip, an emotional voyage, I should say. And the piece begins in harmony, and then there's distress, things starting to go out of whack, mm-hmm. more and more peril, chaos, aggression, stress. And then there's a kind of reckoning scene, facing up to uncomfortable truths, and we see a way to change our mind, change consciousness, and regain equilibrium and harmony.
Mm-hmm. This is not your first go-around with science and dance, is it?
No.
It's not your first dance with
science. Yeah, no, I love to think about science, the objectivity, the fact that it's pushing frontiers of ideas is something that just I find extremely mm-hmm. stimulating. And then I love nature. I love being in nature, hiking, seeing birds, animals. So it's all part of the joy of life for me.
So who had the idea first? Did Paul have the idea and approach you, or did you have the idea for the dance?
I take the blame.
You two go way back, don't you? Paul was talking last night. I saw the performance last night.
I've known Carol since she was 2 years old. And her father was on my doctoral committee. He's a great biologist, so she comes by it naturally.
Mm-hmm. So you had to tell us about the birth of the idea and how you carried it out with Paul.
I had read Paul's paper called The Culture Gap, which, of course, is about climate change, but it's also about culture. And so I realized that this was an approach that could appeal to a mass audience. And I thought that there was a way to compress it and to kind of make a philosophical voyage with the dance. So the text for me is a layer that operates kind of on its own, and then the dance runs parallel and simultaneous, and it takes us on this truly emotional voyage of going through these different phases.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you?
Well, it took it's been over a year in the process of working on the text, making the text work rhythmically, like every word is really chosen to work rhythmically with the music, and then to find the music, and then to the rehearsal process started in August. So it's a long, long project.
And Paul, I know you didn't make the cut as a dancer in this one, but you did have a speaking part. How did you craft that?
Somebody had to do the narration, I and my colleagues are absolutely convinced that just telling people what the science says doesn't change their behavior. Mm-hmm. And so we're trying to recruit people from the arts and from the humanities and so on into the battle to try and preserve civilization. And if you have as a good friend an absolutely top person in the arts, what can you do? Mm-hmm. But as you can hear, my voice isn't up to narrating night after night.
And you had it. I saw the dance Wednesday night. It was terrific. And it's under the big whale, iconic whale at the Museum of Natural History. Did you choose that site? How did you get?
There's a long backstory to that. I originally wanted to do it amongst the dinosaurs, in very narrow spaces. And the health and safety people at the museum said, no way you're going to have dancing in that narrow space. So
it is pretty cramped up there.
It is pretty cramped. But, metaphorically, it was brilliant.
And the word dinosaur, too, is sort of interesting.
So then they offered the Ocean Hall of Life, which is, spectacular. I mean, it was a thrill. And it gave the ability of the dancers to be extreme athletes and very poetic and use the body to the maximum. And to have, 35 dancers on stage is wonderful.
And now that you've done this collaboration together, what do you think are the strengths and the weaknesses of both art and science, Carol, when it comes to tackling climate change? What does each have going for it?
We know that all we can do is try to make people aware, and that we need a great grassroots movement, because clearly the people in power who really are controlling how money is spent, or the oil companies, are not going to change. So it's got to be a populist movement. And so the science gives us the information, and the arts bring us the emotion, and putting it together can motivate people.
Mm-hmm. Paul, were you happy?
I loved it. I think I was so impressed by the athleticism of the dancers, their efforts. And, of course, we do know from science that we need emotions to make decisions. There is no such thing as the rational choice theory. People think that you can make decisions without involving emotions. And what we're doing, what Carol has done, is added emotions to a really difficult scientific topic. And she's done a brilliant job at that. And, who knows whether it'll work. But we do know we need it, and that's really critical.
In fact, one of the things that you notice, if you're already in the museum, American Museum of Natural History, you're sort of there because you respect science and you understand climate change. So you're sort of playing to a converted audience already, aren't you? You must have realized that.
Of course we realize that, but even the converted aren't working hard enough to change society. Even the Ecological Society of America, which contains the scientists who are most involved with the collapse of civilization, really can't bring themselves to communicate with the public the way they ought to. Mm-hmm. And that's where people in the humanities and the arts can come in, who are tuned to communicating with the public. Mm-hmm. Scientists aren't generally trained to communicate with the public.
It's another topic I want to get into, yes.
Well, I think also there were a lot of members of the art world, you know, painters, sculptors, screenwriters, dancers, who don't think about this. So I think it was bringing a topic to those people attending the show, many of whom who don't think about this. So I think it does help to make it real somehow.
Oh, and maybe spur them on.
Well, that's the idea.
To do something.
I mean,
in
as
the
I say, it's a small effort, but everyone needs to do their part.
Mm-hmm. Speaking about scientists speaking out, you made your reputation as a scientist. Going back, I remember seeing you on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson talking about the population bomb. But we don't seem to have scientists willing to speak out a whole lot these days.
Well, we have more willing to speak out, but the mass media no longer make a very, for instance, Carson had an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. He was the most powerful person in Hollywood. NBC didn't want me and Steve Schneider and others on. The people who ran the show didn't want us on.
Is that right?
But John and Ed McMahon wanted us on, particularly John. And John got what he wanted. And he was a great guy. Mm-hmm. Really miss him.
But that was a whole era of the environmental movement. Even Barry Commoner, yeah. Right? He ran for president.
Barry Commoner ran for president. And Carl Sagan ran for God. I mean...
That's true. Carol, was it a big shift? You said you had already tried working with dance, with science. Was this a big shift explicitly about science and about climate change? You have to really narrowly focus it?
Yeah, that was, the literalism of a text that really means something very specific is not the way I usually think about art at all. It's all about the gray area and ambiguity generally. So figuring out this kind of non-judgmental, objective feeling text, it's very matter-of-fact and sort of quotidian, that tone mixed with the highly artificial world of dance was, it was a complex process. But I think it ended up having a great emotional impact because you're sort of seeing people going about their lives the way they do, the metaphor of dance, going about your lives, and then you're hearing the science and you're going, this is what's going on. It's the it is the background upon which we are living now.
Mm-hmm. That's how you explain some of the movements in the dance that particularly struck me. There's a movement that you see the dancers repeat when they're covering their eyes. And what does that little movement say?
Well, that was after the scene of great turbulence and peril and aggression. And it is, of course, people not wanting to face up to what's going on. And sometimes taking their eye away and someone else puts their hand over their eye. So it's about this just having to reckon and gradually coming around to facing.
Mm-hmm. There's also at near the beginning where you have, it struck me, you have people using their hands on the other person's face to sort of support them on their cheek and on their jaw.
Sometimes it's gentle.
Yes.
And you're seeing cooperation, like a hummingbird with a flower. It's just support that way. And then that same thing becomes violent and people pushing each other's face, getting out of the way as the overpopulation scene is happening. There's no more space and everyone's fighting for every little inch of territories. Mm-hmm. And so, you convert the thing so that it has a different meaning and you see this is the way we're potentially headed.
Mm-hmm. And then I thought I saw an element of time toward the end, sort of clocks. You made bodies into clocks, if I saw it correctly.
I am so glad you saw that. That is exactly right. So the clock is ticking, and the music has a kind of ticking melody, and it is in 12 counts, and you see the dancers with their hands and with their entire bodies going around the clock over and over and over again, and it becomes more and more intense and frightening.
And then at the very end, you have two very young dancers come out, two children.
Yes.
What's the message there, that passing it on to the next generation?
Well, I think it's two things at once. It's the kind of innocence and tenderness of the children, and there they are doing this kind of classical ballet. With great dedication, they're living their lives with joy. And again, the background and what they're about to inherit, and then they run to touch the whale, and it's, you know, their love of nature is there, and their innocence, and it's just a reminder that we can return to the kind of harmony and innocence, you should say, in our relationship with nature, as the children do, but we won't return to it unless we do reckon and have a grassroots movement.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with Carol Armitage and Paul Ehrlich. Paul, in the last line of your narration, you ask, could we even learn to love a virus?
Well, you know, people think of viruses as enemies. Therefore, how could one possibly love an enemy? Well, what people miss is, first of all, cats are enemies. I mean, after all, when we were Australopithecines, we find the remains where leopards have eaten them. But we do love cats. And in fact, most people really love big cats as long as they're not eating them. And what people don't know about viruses is they're deadly enemies of some of the worst bacteria that attack us. The ocean is almost a soup of viruses, and we don't know the roles they're playing. So it's really difficult to make judgments about what kinds of organisms we shouldn't love or should love, and is love even the right way to think about it? In other words, we're part of a system they're part of. We want to understand it. We'll appreciate it. And so we decided to throw that line in. Sorry? I think I've got a virus.
You learned to love it.
Yeah, I'm learning.
That's great. So, Carol, do you have any other science ballet or dance in you, do you think?
I hope so. I mean, as I say, it's very inspiring because the thinking makes me think differently. And I think the role of art is to reflect what is going on in culture, but it's not to repeat the past. Mm. It is to find new ways of seeing and experiencing. So science is a wonderful tool for this.
You are a bit of a physics geek.
I love physics. It's true.
Yeah. String theory?
Yeah.
String theory dance?
I know. It sounds incongruous, but when you think about dance is really geometry. You're riding on the air with your body. And, you know, these kalabi-yau forms in string theory, which are a kind of complicated geometry, that is what makes the string vibrate at a certain pitch, which influences its movement. So, you know, metaphors like that are just fantastic for dance.
So, I mean, that sounds correct. Dance would be perfect for vibrating strings, right?
It's a celestial universe.
So maybe you need some dark energy or dark matter dance or something.
Oh, yeah, that I haven't studied that yet.
Very attractive. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all attractive, dark, pushing away, pulling together. That's perfect for dance, too, it would seem.
You're right. Time and space, pushing, pulling. That's what it's all about.
And so you have one more performance tonight at the American Museum of Natural History under the Big Blue Whale. And
that's right.
A lot of people can come down and take away a message about climate change in a time when it's, you know, we're even in a political season, Paul.
Yeah, even a political season, especially. In a political season, we got to do more of this.
You think, are you and your colleagues going to be? I know you can't be vocal today, but.
I'll recover and be vocal enough. They can come to the American Museum and hear me croak.
That's right. You won't hear him a frog very much. How do you view the conservative right attacks on science these days?
Sad. I thought, as I think a lot of people thought, that the Enlightenment was part of a trend, and now we're in the middle of an endarkenment. We have a Congress where most of the people have no idea how the world works, and yet the big problems facing our society almost all have a major scientific component that we've got to understand. Mm-hmm. And so, again, the kind of stuff Carol's doing is one of the last hopes, and all of us, or me and my friends, are all behind it.
Well, we wish you great success, and don't break a voice tonight or something. Break a leg at a dancer. One more performance tonight at the American Museum of Natural History under the Whale. It's Carol Armitage. She's the founder and artistic director of Armitage Gone, a dance company here in New York. And, of course, you all know Paul Ehrlich, professor of biology and population studies at Stanford in Stanford, California. Thank you both.
Great pleasure to be here.
Lending us whatever is left of your voice for today. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk with a cognitive neuroscientist, Michael Gazzaniga. He's been around, half a century, about the mysteries of our brain. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. How many brains do you have? What a question. Of course, the simple answer is that you have one. But neuroscientists might argue that you have two: the right hemisphere, which organizes information in space and time, and the left side, that's in charge of speech and language. But it was only some 50 years ago that scientists came up with this two-brain idea. They did it by studying epileptic patients who had certain treatments for their seizures, and that was that the connection between both sides of the brains was snipped, separating the two sides. And the scientists then gave these patients a problem to solve.
When the patient tries to solve the problem with his right hand, which is governed from the left hemisphere, we find that he is not capable of doing it. Namely, that the right hand, which is governed from the left hemisphere, is intrinsically incapable of performing this kind of visual constructional tasks.
That's Dr. Michael Gazzaniga, my next guest, giving a play-by-play on some of his earliest brain experiments some decades ago. His first desk was a hallway at Caltech, and now he's moved up to some better digs. He's the director of the Sage Center for the Study of the Mind at UC Santa Barbara, and his new book is Tales from Both Sides of the Brain, A Life in Neuroscience. And he has the distinction of being, I think, the first neuroscientist I ever interviewed way back in the 1970s, if memory serves. Welcome to Science Friday, Michael.
Oh, thank you, Ira. It's great to be here.
Great to have you back. Where have you been all these years?
In the field.
Let's talk about that. Now that you're a veteran scientist, what do you remember most about your whole career? What strikes you about your whole career?
Oh, wanting to get up every morning and go do it, and all the fun that comes along with the joys of scientific discovery. It's one of the things I try to communicate in this book is that science is not this lonely enterprise that you go off into a room and think all these great thoughts and everything happens in some, you know, pristine way. It happens yeah. through friendships. It happens in all kinds of cool ways. So I can't complain about my last 50 years. It's been a lot of fun.
In fact, you talk about psychologist George Miller in your book saying, quote, "Everybody wants to think science moves forward one clean hypothesis at a time. It moves forward, yeah. but usually by stumbling on something that was unintended."
It happens all the time, embarrassingly so. I can't think of the number of experiments that I had planned to go one way, and this pesky little result comes up that just does not fit. And you have to go back and think about it, and then you finally figure out what's going on, and of course you advance science. The scientist can be a little frustrated because his pet little idea didn't work, but ultimately if you're doing your game right, you're finding out what actually is going on in a given situation. So
did you
it's great.
Did you have one of those aha moments when you were doing these split brain experiments?
Well, back then, what we did know at the time was that splitting the brain, as you described, in cats and monkeys really resulted in this dramatic difference of one side of the brain didn't know what the other was doing. But at that time, the predominant evidence for humans was that it didn't do anything, that for some reason, people born without this structure didn't show any of these split brain effects. And in the 1940s, 20 or so cases had been operated on in Rochester, and the reports that came out of those cases said that no effect was seen. So when we started that 50 years ago at Caltech, in some odd way, there were low expectations in the sense that the predominant human work didn't show anything, even though there was a strong body of animal work.
So you waited for the right opportunity to test this out on people?
It was truly a perfect storm. A resident at the time, a neurosurgical resident at the time who had associations with Caltech, convinced his mentor that they should try this surgery again for the medical reason of controlling epilepsy. And Joe Bogan, the resident, convinced Roger Sperry that the patient should be tested both preoperatively and postoperatively, and for a bunch of reasons I go into, they picked me to do it. And one of the reasons they may have picked me was nobody thought anything would happen. And the low man on the totem pole in the lab, I was a new graduate student at the time. And anyway, and then what happened was this extremely dramatic result that you would place an object in the left hand of the patient and they couldn't find the matching object in the right hand after the surgery. So we had something like two minds going on.
Was that WJ? Was that your first?
That was WJ. That was Case WJ, yeah.
And so you learned from him that, well, not just that the brains were separated, but what else?
I would say that the overall impact immediately was that mental processes and therefore ultimately understanding consciousness was rooted in biology. It really motivated the notion that if we can figure out the underlying brain mechanisms, we may be able to understand these complex processes. So at the time, what that meant was that the left brain seemed to be the only hemisphere that could talk and understand language and do complex reasoning. And the right brain had these curious specializations, too, that you mentioned, being able to put together visual images into a particular motor response. And together, it looked like that's where the whole popularized notion of left brain, right brain came out of. And it was a little oversold. And as we moved on through the study of these patients and others for 50 years, we learned it's not quite that simple.
Yeah, because we, you know, everybody walks around saying I'm left hand, but I'm a right brain person. That's too
right. It's fun, cheap. What's the new word now? Edutainment. it's a little something. It's a little something, and it's a lot of fun.
Michael, that word's 30 years old.
We're both going back to my business. not in my business yet.
Is it true for your work that do you still have people who have split brains like that who try to cope with everyday life?
Oh yeah, the one of the major features of the surgery is that your best friends could have it, and you wouldn't know it unless you place them in special testing situations. It's a remarkable that even though the two half brains are separated, that they learn all these ways to cooperate to look and be able to carry out acts that you give one side of the brain versus the other. The patients do not seem different from anybody unless you do this very specialized testing.
So are there people who have this disjointed in their brain and they don't know it?
I think so. Yeah, yeah. There are a number of cases that come up like that from tumors, from many strokes. But the ones that have been studied so extensively and made up the scientific literature were all patients who were surgically sectioned, as you described.
Mm-hmm. We've gone on to learn how plastic, you know, that word came into vogue about the brain. Is the brain as plastic as we think it is, or are we giving it too much credit, like you would say, with the left brain, right brain people?
Well, the field hopes for plasticity. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to repair disordered brains, brains that are failing in some way. And so the notion of plasticity is always at the tip of the tongue. The reality of it is slow go. There's not a magic pill or a magic treatment or a magic anything that can reverse serious brain conditions. But everybody's trying to find the pill that'll make our memories better. Everybody's trying to find the pill that will fix patients mm-hmm. who are suffering from Parkinson's disease and the like. Mm-hmm. So the concepts out there, the desires out there, there's some systems that look like there is plasticity going on. If one comes right out of the split brain research, in some of the patients, a minority of the patients, after, in one case, 20 years, the right hemisphere, which was silent for 20 years, finally had something to say, I guess, and spoke. And so what is that? What underlies that change in the fact that this silent half brain now can utter a word? So there are examples of plasticity, but getting a handle on it and trying to understand how it would work so you could do it in different situations is really a challenge.
There's also a movement that's been going on for many years about using MRIs, magnetic resonant imaging, to watch the brain light up, right, as it's working to figure out what's going on there. And critics have said, you know, this again is an oversimplistic view of what's happening in the brain. What's your take on that?
The brain imaging work has illuminated all kinds of issues. It has shown that, for example, when someone is carrying out in their mind's eye a mental image. They have a mental image of something. And as that mental image becomes bigger in their mind's eye, they can show how different parts of the visual system light up to in correspondence with that rather subjective state. So the notion that these brain images are capturing fleeting mental processes is pretty well established. The issue now is how all the, and so you find these all over the place. You find them when someone is thinking about the intentions of another person, you find another part of the brain lighting up. When someone is thinking about trying to control their span of memory, another area is lighting up. The game is to, well, we got all these places lighting up. How do they coordinate themselves into the personal sense of conscious unity that you and I enjoy? And that will take a different level of analysis. I think it'll take a different kind of thinking to get close to that answer.
Well, that's a question I was trying to get to. Is it possible, because we're inside the box, we have a brain, right, for us to understand consciousness, reality, things like that? Do we have to be outside the box looking into the box?
Well, The problem of consciousness and the physical basis of consciousness is that what drives a lot of people to stay in this field and try to figure it out. And there's all kinds of theories. The one that I'm comfortable with after doing this work for 50 years and studying these patients that have had their brains separated is that consciousness is a very local process that energizes a local specific capacity. And that's a fancy way of saying what? So if you can just sit here for a moment yourself, look at the wall in front of you and fixate on a point. And everything to the left of your fixation point visually now is going to your right brain. And yet you can name it, right? You can easily name and describe it. Mm-hmm. Well, in a split brain patient, if they fixate the wall, everything to the left of the fixation point also is going to the right hemisphere, but since they have no speech in the right hemisphere, the left hemisphere answers and says, I didn't see anything. I can't see anything. And you would think that the patient would comment about that at the conscious level, but they don't. They don't think anything is wrong or anything is off. And so what you begin to have this, consider this bizarre thought that, well, maybe the consciousness about that part of the sensory world is localized in the right hemisphere. And so vis-a-vis the left hemisphere, there's nothing wrong because the left hemisphere, it's like being worried about stuff behind your head that you can't see. If you're not worried about that, it's kind of out of sight, out of mind. And now after the surgery, the right hemisphere's duties of looking at the left visual field are out of mind for the left hemisphere. Okay, that's all true. Now, what does that mean for how conscious processes are organized by the brain? And so I think it's not some central system that where all our cognition and perception goes into this wonderful mechanism and it gets activated to our conscious experience. Mm-hmm. I think all these local zones of activity are part of the conscious reality, and they manufacture their own at the moment in time that you're conscious of that act, whatever it is you're thinking about.
Does that make sense? Yeah, it does. Talking with Michael Gazzaniga, author of Tales from Two Sides of the Brain on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. So, where is the cutting edge in research now? Where is it in brain research?
Well, there's a very exciting program, as everybody knows, that the Obama administration has proposed a new brain initiative, and that in part was motivated by these spectacular advances in getting to know all the physical details of a brain, how the networks of a brain can vary from one person to another, from one animal to another. And so over the next 20 years, you're going to see just a flood of activity and learning more and more about the parts of the brain.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but the next challenge, excuse me?
No, go ahead.
So the next big challenge is once you've got the parts, you've got to figure out how they interact. And that's going to take what it's referred to as dynamical thinking. It's going to take, I think, people from the field of engineering who are into control and dynamic systems to come in and say, okay, how can we build a model of these parts all interacting? And so my guess is that in 20 years, maybe sooner, 15 years, the kind of description that will come forth as an explanation for how the brain does something will not look like the kinds of little baby descriptions we have now. Yeah. It'll be quite complex, and it'll be a different language.
Michael Gazzaniga, thank you very much for taking time to be with us today. Fascinating, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Michael Gazzaniga is director of the Sage Center, University of California, Santa Barbara, and author of the book, a great book, Tales from Two Sides of the Brain. And you can read an excerpt from the book on our website at sciencefriday.com/brainbook. One last thing. Pick up your pen and draw a horse galloping or a speeding locomotive, something moving fast. Now, which direction is it moving? Peter Walker is a psychologist at Lancaster University in the UK, and he looked up images of things in motion and compared them to images of those things, same things, that were at rest. And in a study recently published in the journal Perception, he says that when we picture rapidly moving things, we have a preference for things that go from left to right, not from right to left. Why? Well, he speculates it's because most people are right-handed.
If you want to interact successfully with a moving object, you really want the object to be moving slightly left to right rather than right to left, because that means it's going to intersect with your right hand, and you'll have more success because that's the most efficient and the most dexterous hand.
Walker says the effect is pretty pronounced. Running cheetahs and pictures went right to left almost 70% of the time. Went to the right, I should say. Gazelles over 60%. The same with missiles in flight. The effects broke down, though, with hares. Walker thinks it might be because we think of rapids zigzagging randomly and scampering, not moving in a straight line. Time for us to scamper, too. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer. Christopher Intagliata, Alexa Lim, our associate producer. Sarge producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Our production assistant, Becky Fogel. Rich Kim, our technical director. Sarah Fishman, our engineer at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. We also had help today from Ann Hepperman and Jen Kwok. And if you're prepping for an Easter egg hunt next week, don't forget the vinegar.
So when you add vinegar to egg dye, it does two things. It slowly dissolves the egg shell a little bit, which increases the surface area of the egg and gives the egg dye more places to stick to. It also positively charges the egg shell so that negative egg dye molecules can stick to it better.
You can learn more about our latest education activity, Eggs to Die For. Get it? All at sciencefriday.com/egg dye. And tune in next week for an extravaganza episode of our Food Failure series. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.